Zelensky was asking again for more weapons in terms of and here is what Keith Kellogg said on Fox News, if I'm not mistaken.
This is a permanent comprehensive ceasefire, sea, air, land, infrastructure for a minimum of 30 days, and then we can extend that. He's absolutely right. The president has this one right on the money. And that's where we want to go to. And when you look at everything the Ukrainians are willing to work with, now it's over to the Russians, over to Putin. Okay, we've got one side. Now you need to come up the other side. And I think we're close. Look.
Yeah, we're close, but it seems that the permanent ceasefire is not the solution right now for the moment for Russia. And but Donald Trump wants a permanent ceasefire. Do you think that they're getting closer to reach a deal? We can be optimistic about it.
Sergei Lavrov gave an interview to a Brazilian newspaper where he, for the first time, spelled out in great detail what Russia's preconditions are. The Russians don't publish preconditions publicly. They don't make declaratory policy of this nature just to back away. So these are the non-negotiables. And there is a tremendous amount of daylight between what Lavrov said and what Keith Kellogg said. I would be careful about listening to Keith Kellogg, though. See, what we have in the Trump administration is a Jekyll and Hyde administration when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. And what I mean by that is there is a camp in which Keith Kellogg, Marco Rubio, maybe Mike Waltz and others are in, that have these artificial expectations about what peace will look like. These are people who have never been supportive of a point of view that's sympathetic to the Russian position. Then you have another camp, J.D. Vance, Tulsi Gabbard, Steve Witkoff, Pete Hegseth, who I call it the realists. These are the people who, for the first time in a long time, maybe ever in modern U.S.-Russian relations, are actually doing what JFK asked people to do in his American University speech back in June of 1963, where he said, you need to put yourself in the shoes of the other side. You need to have empathy, because now we have senior American officials who are saying, we understand the Russian perspective, and the Russians are right. The Russians have a right to feel this way. The Russians have a right to believe that NATO expansion was a threat, because it was a threat. And these are people that are more sympathetic to the positions put out by Sergei Lavrov. I think the reason why Lavrov went public with this is that there was too many assumptions were being made in the halls of power about what Russia would be willing to concede. And I think by laying this down, it just becomes clear. So again, now Keith Kellogg is no longer relevant because everything he wants isn't reflected in reality. This puts the impetus on the reality camp. Witkoff, backed up by, Hegseth and Gabbard. These are the people now that, need to close this deal. It would help if we spoke to Ukraine with a single voice. But again, we have this Jekyll and Hyde approach, a good cop, bad cop, where we're, talking to Ukraine. And if I were the Ukrainians, I wouldn't know where the hell America's coming from. I mean, is America going to help us? Are you not going to help us? What do you believe in? What is a security guarantee? I mean, for the Ukrainians, and I don't normally have sympathy for the Ukrainians because I don't support their position, but I am sympathetic here because how hard is it to deal with the United States when you don't know, what the policy direction is? Even the president, one minute he's talking about, supporting Ukraine. We need to do this. We need to have this. The other minute he's saying, well, the Russians have a good point of view here. But you got to bring these two things together, and it's only going to be done in a way that's to the detriment of Ukraine. This war doesn't end with Ukraine getting anything it wants. That's the reality. And so long as the United States creates the perception that Ukraine can get stuff that it wants, there will be no agreement. Russia's laid it out. So I think ultimately what's going to happen, we're either going to have to literally squeeze Ukraine and Europe because, Europe is like I mean, you've raised children, so you understand. Sometimes there's the child wants something, and for obvious parental reasoning, the child's not going to get it. But now the mother and the father have to be on the same sheet of music. You know, it doesn't help if the father lays down the law, then the mother turns around and consoles the baby and gives them candy and rewards their bad behavior, makes the father the bad guy, etc. Or it could be the other way around, where the father consoles the baby, makes the mother a bad guy. But if the mother and the father aren't on the same sheet of music, the kid's going to get the wrong message. And they're going to go off thinking that they're going to get what they want, even though the decision's been made. Europe is the bad parent here. Europe is the one continuing to tell Ukraine, no, don't worry, you're going to get what you want. Don't worry what your father says. You're going to get what you want. We have to shut Europe up. And we really do. We have to find a way just to shut this thing down. And you saw that with Macron. Trump knows who the enemy is. Trump knows who the problem is. He told Macron, you're not welcome here. Get out. This is between me and him. You know, you're not part of this discussion. It's the same thing with Keir Starmer. Same thing with anybody in Europe. They're not helping this at all. They think they're helping Ukraine, but they're not, because all they're doing is they're creating a situation where Ukraine is going to be compelled to continue a struggle that Russia, instead of finishing it on the negotiation table, will finish it on the battlefield. In 2 years from now, there won't be a Ukraine. Or there will be a major war between Russia and Europe that the United States may have to intervene on and undo all this work. And that war could lead to exchange of nuclear weapons. Europe is the problem, the greatest problem we face. Now, in some ways, this European problem is self-policing. And what I mean by that is, you know, the threat of French, British military intervention evaporates if Romania next month votes in a government that says, we're done playing that game. Macron has talked about potential parliamentary elections this summer, and there's every reason to believe that Marine Le Pen's party will prevail, and that we'll get a parliament that's openly hostile to this, and that could compel Macron to resign, paving the way for a different French government that'll be walking away from these policies. Who knows how long Keir Starmer can stay in power before there's a demand, a vote of no confidence, et cetera. There's a whole multitude of issues that he's confronting. Germany, you know, AfD is now the largest party in Germany. You know, Germany has this policy of, you know, none of the parties will cooperate with AfD. So even with the slim margin that they have, they can't govern. But as Germany devolves, as their economy collapses, AfD is just going to grow stronger and stronger and stronger until the point comes that parties are going to recognize that if they don't cooperate with AfD, then they will be eliminated. They won't exist anymore. I think that, you know, the new German government lasts a year, if that, before there's a vote of no confidence and we get more snap elections. And I think AfD is on its path towards becoming the dominant power in Germany, and that changes everything. So, you know, there's in the long run, I think Europe solves its own self by self-destructing. But in the short term, and that's what's important here, you know, Europe is causing problems for peace in Ukraine. Zelensky, if you look at what Lavrov laid out, the interesting thing is that the place where the Russians are softest on is denazification, because traditionally denazification, we were led to believe that means that's the end of the Zelensky government, he's out, etc. And Russia seems to have softened that stance. And now they're looking for constitutional protections for the Russian speakers and protection of the so they've softened denazification, which is a big carrot to Zelensky, because it means that he can say, now Zelensky's not going to stay in, because I think Medvedev said it right. He's going to meet a violent end very soon, I believe, as he is compelled to make compromises towards a peace settlement. The Banderists are going to kill him. And then we devolve, it falls down. I think that's the big Russian plan. I think one of the reasons why the Russians have softened their position here is that they understand the direction that Ukraine is headed politically, and they're confident that from the chaos they will be able to impose a more sympathetic government to Russia and its needs. But the other area where there might be some leverage is demilitarization. Russia wants a Ukraine that is totally weakened, totally demilitarized, that can never pose a threat. And I don't know if that's realistic to achieve. If a compromise can be reached that has Ukraine recognizing Crimea, but not recognizing the four territories, but the international community, while not recognizing the four territories, lifts the sanctions related to that so that the four territories become de facto acknowledged as to Russia. And then you size the Ukrainian military such that it is a legitimate defense force, but not an offensive force that capable of threatening these regions. There might be room for a compromise here. But, you know, Russia is not going to back away from the four territories, no NATO membership, Crimea, Russia, and the need to be confident that they're just not, by engaging in this permanent ceasefire, that they're just not creating the conditions that empower Ukraine to get ready to do it all over again. You know, Russia needs some guarantees on that too. I don't know if this is possible. I don't know if this is possible. It's not possible with Europe continuing to coddle. It's not possible with Trump sending mixed signals to Ukraine. I mean, Keith Kellogg, you just shut up. There should only be one voice speaking on behalf of the Trump administration. But now we have these two schools of thought, and that just encourages Ukraine. And I think that means that Russia will end up resolving this on the battlefield. And that'll be to the extreme detriment of Ukraine, and it creates the potential of European engagement. Because what do nations do when they have domestic political problems? They look for external threats. And so as Europe starts to devolve, there will be more and more of a tendency to say, our threat is with Russia here in Ukraine, and we have to stop our fighting and go focus on that. It's a dangerous situation. I wish the Trump administration would speak with a single voice and take a much more proactive position in that aligns more closely with Russia than Ukraine.
Yeah, here is Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov stated that Kiev doesn't have full control over its own military units and therefore can hardly guarantee adherence to any ceasefire agreement. If they don't have the full control over their army, who's the other party that is running the show in Ukraine? Is that Zelensky? Is that the United Kingdom through Zelensky? Because Zelensky has some sort of leverage. We can understand that because he was the commander in chief. He was the head of Ukrainian army. What's your speculation on that?
I don't think Zelensky has the influence that you think he does. He's in the United Kingdom as the ambassador. There's a connectivity between him and the British that, you know, has been established. But for him, Zelensky isn't projecting his voice into Ukraine as effectively as some people. The power comes from the Banderists. I mean, look who the Azov battalion became an Azov brigade, which became an assault regiment, which became a division-sized unit. Now it's a corps-sized unit, and it's taken over every aspect of Ukrainian defense. It's taking over the drones. It's taking over the defense industry. And they're starting to dictate outcomes. You just had a Ukrainian brigade commander who's loyal to the Banderist ideology tell Zelensky that if he concedes the territories, that they're going to kill him. That's not Zelensky. That's internal. This is the danger of allowing the Banderists to exist and to infiltrate themselves into government during wartime, because they use the extremes that are promulgated by war to empower themselves. And today, you know, the Azov Corps is the most powerful military unit out there. And they will start dictating, realities. Zelensky, I don't think Zelensky could make peace, even if he wanted to make peace. That's the other reality of it, which means that the only way that you resolve this is you have to physically destroy the Ukrainian military.
Yeah. I really, just to wrap up this session, Scott, I really do feel that Steve Witkoff is the man for this administration. When you look at the way he talks, when you look at his manner, in both talks, with Iran and with Russia, you see somebody that you have for such a long time, you haven't been witnessing or seeing or expecting in the administration in the United States. It's a fresh air to the foreign policy of the United States. Do you think that his manner would influence the talks that are happening right now, which are so much important? I'm not trying to diminish one or the other. Both talks with Ukraine and in the Middle East with Iran are important for the United States foreign policy.
I think his voice is the only one that counts at this point in time. Hegseth, it's important for Hegseth to weigh in, especially on the issue of Iran and avoiding war. And I would like Hegseth to weigh in more about the futility of continued military support for Ukraine. But Witkoff is not a product of the deep state. He's not a product of the American diplomatic establishment. He has been tainted by decades of flawed thinking, flawed analysis, flawed assumptions. He is a businessman. But as important as that is, he's a friend of Donald Trump, which means that he is here to support Donald Trump. And what's interesting is by praising Steve Witkoff, you are by extension praising Donald Trump, because Witkoff operates as an extension of Donald Trump. He's not there to try and influence Trump. He's there to report accurately back to Trump because he understands what Trump wants, what Trump's trying to achieve. I am a huge fan of Witkoff. I know that there's people upset with him about Gaza and about Israel, but guys, that problem is so damn complicated. Nobody's going to be able to, you're just not going to get the fixes there that you want. But on Russia, on Iran, I think Witkoff's been brilliant. And what we may get out of Russia is the ability for the United States to walk away from Ukraine while continuing to improve relations with Russia. Again, that is a very pragmatic, realistic approach that, only a new thinker like Witkoff could do. Marco Rubio is incapable of that kind of thinking. So is anybody that has a, linkage back to the deep state, to the establishment way of thinking. Witkoff is a breath of fresh air, as you said. He, I believe that he is giving us the only hope for peaceful outcomes. This is why I was so against Kamala Harris. Not necessarily her as an individual, although yes, but the fact that she was very much a tool of the establishment, and that as president, we would be headed towards a nuclear war with Russia and a nuclear war with Iran. And because she would be totally 100% dependent upon the advice being proffered by establishment thinkers.
Yeah. Sullivan would be in the administration. For
yeah,
sure.
I mean, Sullivan, Blinken, we'd be at war. Witkoff couldn't exist in a Kamala Harris administration. Witkoff can only exist in a Donald Trump administration. And he may turn out to be the savior of us all, because there is still, very powerful establishment forces and voices in the Trump administration, no matter how revolutionary he is. I mean, how revolutionary can you be when Marco Rubio is your Secretary of State? But Witkoff is a complete, he's divorced from the baggage of the past. He is solely focused on the potential of the present and the future. And I'm optimistic. Whenever I see him dispatch someplace, I'm optimistic because I just feel that pragmatic reality is prevailing over, you know, the old failed policies of the past.
In my opinion, what's killing the United States is the old policies of the Cold War and those sort of mindset. They don't just let them go. The world has changed. You have to have new policies. It doesn't seem that would be the case for that establishment in the United States, even though you have Donald Trump in office, and it doesn't change anything. You look at Ukraine, you look at the Middle East, the same sort of mindset.
Yeah. It's impossible, Nima, because it's ingrained. And much has to do with the fact that for 75, almost 80 years, they were the undisputed number one, the unilateral moment, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. Even after 9/11, they still thought that they were number one and this was going to be the new American century. They were only 25 years ago. They were convinced that this would be the new American century. So it's ingrained. And when you are in Washington, which is a very provincial place, and you talk to these people from different agencies, you go to a dinner in one of the good restaurants in Washington, everybody sitting on that table works for the government, for an agency, for the industrial military complex, et cetera. You know, so it's a bubble. So they only talk to themselves. They simply don't pay attention to foreigners. They don't listen to foreigners. And they think that foreigners, by definition, are inferior. How can they learn? How can they learn that the Cold War is over? It's still going on in their minds. It doesn't matter that if not against the communists, it's again an autocratic dictator, or it's against the communists in China, or it's against the mullahs in Iran, or whatever, all those stupid cliches that they use all the time. So it's their incapacity to get out of the bubble, to start looking at the world outside of their little window. And that explains why the Cold War still lives. And then when you have a first-class diplomat telling them, like Lavrov or like Wang Yi, they get mad. They don't even understand why a top-class diplomat is telling them, look, try to get rid of your Cold War mentality. It's going to be much better for you. It's impossible for them to understand.
You look at the situation in Ukraine today, and Russia, I don't know if you saw the interview that Lavrov did with Global News.
I did. By the way, excellent. It was a written responses, and you could see that the responses were carefully calibrated. Yeah? Uh-huh.
The question is, what else Donald Trump need to understand the position of Russia? They're just out there. Everything is out there.
Everything is out there, explicitly, detailed, carefully argued, explained and re-explained, not only by Lavrov, by everybody in the foreign ministry, by Putin himself in all the fora last year and the fora this year as well. You hit an iron wall all the time.
Yeah.
So in practical terms, apparently the former New York real estate developer Witkoff may be starting to understand a few things. Considering the whole system in Washington, this is huge already. But it's like this. It depends on one individual. Can you imagine if Kellogg was the guy in charge instead of Witkoff? We'll be on the brink of two wars. A renewed war against Russia and a new war against Iran.
Yeah. That's why I think that Witkoff is somehow can be helpful in the process of
Yes.
negotiation, and because he's different. He doesn't have those.
And at least he's willing to listen, Nima. He's willing to listen, apparently. Considering all the leaks, apparently he's willing to listen. And he respects Putin a lot. That's very, very important. We don't know about his relationship with Araghchi. I would love to answer this question in Iran, assuming we can get an answer. How do they view the relationship between Witkoff and Araghchi? Because you need to create mutual trust in a negotiation at this high level. For instance, with all their faults, with all their problems, the relationship between Zarif and Kerry was quite decent. Was quite decent. And it helped because they it came a time when they noticed that they actually understand each other. And that created mutual respect. It was very, very helpful. So if something like this happens between Araghchi and Witkoff, that would be a plus.